On Saturday at the Buffalo Humanities Festival, Professor Adam Rome of the University of Buffalo History Department is offering a talk called My Walks with Olmsted. He gave us a preview during a recent chat at Olmsted's Delaware Park.
But did they approach you about coming up with an idea? Did you suggest it to them? I mean, how did that go?
Yeah, David Castillo knew that I had just come to Buffalo, and I had met him socially, and we had talked a little bit about one of the things I was working on was Frederick Law Olmsted. And he said, "Oh, you know, we've got this humanities festival every year, and we have a theme, and this year the theme is environment, and it would be great if you were interested in giving a talk." And more broadly, my expertise is the history of our relationship to the environment, the history of the modern environmental movement. So I've thought a lot about sustainability in a lot of contexts. But when I came to Buffalo and bought a house not far from Delaware Park, it made Olmsted even more a part of my life and part of my thoughts.
The name Olmsted probably in the last 15 to 20 years, mainly because of the conservancy, I think,
right,
has really become a name that most Western New Yorkers know. But at the same time, I think when they think of Olmsted, they're thinking, well, a nice park. You know, he created these nice parks, parkways, and I don't know if there's necessarily an immediate jump to environment.
Well, he lived for most of the 19th century, and he lived through almost every important thing that happened, from, you know, the Civil War to the corruption of the Gilded Age and the rise of industrialism. And every part of his life, he was really, but even long before he became a landscape architect, which wasn't until he was in his 40s, he was thinking about what makes sustainable community. And he had all kinds of opportunities to think about that. And he also was always interested in, or he always recognized that part of sustainability involved having a sustainable relationship with our environment. So he worked on all kinds of other things beside parks. He was a pioneer in promoting conservation of resources, especially forests. He was very interested in public health. Some of his parks had public health benefits. He spent time in California during the Civil War running a mining company, but he also got entrusted with figuring out what to do with Yosemite, which at the time was not yet a national park. And his ideas about that were among the first to really say, we need to protect these people, these parks, these sublime places for all the people. Otherwise, they'll be monopolized by the rich. He helped protect Niagara Falls. Niagara Falls was unbelievably industrialized by the late 19th century. And he was part of a movement that said, no, we need to ensure that at least part of it is beautiful, sublime, free of all kinds of development. And that was really the first successful preservation campaign in the country. So he was thinking about environment in all kinds of ways. He was also interested in agriculture and more sustainable ways of farming. When the New York Times was a brand new newspaper, they sent him to the South to report on slavery. And one of the things that struck him was that slavery didn't encourage people to take care of the land. It encouraged them to exploit it, just like they were exploiting the people. So he was thinking about all these things all through his life. He wasn't just a park maker.
At the same time, though, when you look at him and his views on sustainability, and then you look out at this park, Delaware Park, right here in front of us, how do you see the two coming together?
One of the things that's really, really struck me now that I can walk in the park every day, and also there's a fantastic history of the Buffalo Park System that's called The Best Planned City in the World by Francis Kowski, who used to teach at Buff State. And that's been really helpful to me also in thinking about this, because all the parks have changed, and some way more than others. And many of them were controversial in their days, so Olmsted didn't always get what he wanted. And I think when you think about it, I mean, Delaware Park, where we're standing, Olmsted first came to talk about in 1868. So that's almost exactly 150. It was August 1868, almost exactly 150 years ago. So the idea that something that was conceived 150 years ago could still be an incredibly important, vital part of the city is amazing to me. There are not that many institutions of any kind that are 150 years old. But obviously also it's had to adapt the park does a lot of different things than it did in Olmsted's day, and it's been changed. So that's part of sustainability, I think, that it can't just mean stasis. It can't just mean keeping things the same. Sometimes when circumstances change, if you try to keep things the same, all that means is they'll die, and that's the essence of unsustainability. Right. So even though the park's changed, it's an evolutionary process, which is, I think, what sustainability requires.
At the same time, are there basics that he envisioned that was part of his original layout for Delaware Park that have helped them sustain throughout these years?
He had so many goals for parks. So one goal was for you as an individual to find a kind of respite from the hustle and bustle, the noise, the chaos, the pollution of the city. And so his original conception of Delaware Park was a place of quiet, pastoral contemplation. And it isn't that much that anymore. There's parts of the park that you can still experience that, but other parts are quite busy most of the time. Although, like this morning, overcast skies, I walk over here. I didn't see a single person as I walked around Lake Hoyt. And it was fabulous to be able to enjoy the thunderstorm when it came and the sheen of gray that came over everything. But he also had social goals for the park, that he wanted the park to bring people together. And this is one of the places where our ideas would be different partially. So he wanted the upper classes to essentially help instruct the lower classes in what it meant to be good citizens and good neighbors. And so you were supposed to admire them as they came by in their carriages. We totally reject that idea now. But it's still a place where people come together. And I would say, actually, it's a place where they come together as equals. Everyone's entitled to use the park. And the diversity of people is much greater than it was even in Olmsted's time. So you can't help trying to think, what do I share with all these people as you're walking through the park? And I think that was something that Olmsted wanted us to constantly be thinking about. What do we have in common in spite of obvious differences of class or ethnicity or religion?
Again, I'll keep going back to the word sustainability,
right,
or environment. There seems to be, when it comes to sustainability, when it comes to the environment, there seems to be not a class divide necessarily, but there most certainly is an attitude divide, especially politically.
I think one thing that he would say, and a lot of environmentalists especially kind of lose sight of this, is that sustainability, although it began with thinking about the fate of the earth, is ultimately not just an environmental issue. It's a social issue. It's an economic issue. It's a political issue. It's a moral issue. And it's something that we all have to think about. It's not something only for scientists or engineers or landscape architects. So I think that would be the first thing that he would say is, this isn't really about the planet. It's about us. It's about whether we continue to thrive, whether we can build communities that we're happy in, that we're inspired by, that work for us in all the different ways that we hope a community will work for us. So I think that would be the first thing he'd say is, let's just stop talking only about the environment. You know, we do have to find political ways of finding agreement. We do have to find ways to meet the economic needs of all kinds of different people. We do have to find ways of making sure that socially we can have empathy for other people and understand where they're coming from and hope that they'll do the same so that we, you know, can live together. I think that would be one important lesson. That probably wouldn't by itself be enough to overcome the horrible political divide that we have now. But I think it goes a long way. It's an important lesson.
Let's talk about your view of this park. Like you said, you're bringing some fresh eyes to the park.
Right. I had only been to Buffalo once before I moved here or thought about moving here. But this park system is really important nationally. At the point that Olmsted designed these parks with his partner Calvert Vaux, he'd only designed Central Park and Prospect Park in New York and what was then Brooklyn. And this was the first time that he had the chance to conceive of a park system. And that in and of itself, I think, is fascinating because he understood that it can't just be about aesthetics, that it has to be about anticipating economic development and where people will live and what they will be doing decades and decades into the future. So that requires all kinds of skills besides simply knowing what plants will grow where and what they'll look like, although he did an amazing job of just about that. So that's been one of the fun things for me. I mean, I live near Delaware Park, but I've also been exploring the other Olmsted parks in the city. And Olmsted himself changed his mind about parks. So his original conception of Delaware Park had no formal recreation. You were just supposed to walk around and look. No baseball, no soccer, no – my favorite of late was – 5-year-old kids playing rugby, none of that. No ultimate frisbee, no Shakespeare in the Park for that matter, or no art and music in the park. All of that wasn't part of his original vision. But when he came back, he kept coming back to the city in the 70s and the 80s. And when he originally proposed South Park, by then in the 1880s, he'd realized you need recreation, that needs to be built in. His original park system had one park that was going to have playing fields, one that was going to have, you know, parade grounds and music, and then this park for contemplation. But South Park was originally going to have all of those things. And that, is, again, was a recognition that in a generation things had changed. So I think even Olmsted himself, I'm not sure if he saw the kids playing rugby, would he say, that's a desecration of my idea? That's not what he originally envisioned. Or would he say, no, I mean, even by the end of my life, I could see that parks had to serve multiple purposes and not everyone wanted the same thing out of them. And that's part of being a community, is recognizing that people have diverse needs and you got to find a way to accommodate that.
And so we stand here in the Rose Garden, undercover, unfortunately. Talk about maybe your favorite elements of this park. What's capturing your imagination?
One other thing, one reason I thought it would be fun to meet here is that people get married here. And, you know, I've only lived here a year, but I've seen dozens of weddings. And they're really quite different. You know, people come in traditional clothing. I remember one time someone had traditional drums as he was playing as the processional. Again, I think that's magnificent to see the incredible diversity of people in Buffalo and in the park, and trying to imagine, you know, where they came from, what their hopes are. Some of them are the same as our hopes, obviously, that when they're getting married, they're hoping to have a joyous, long life together and a wonderful family. But they may have lots of other thoughts that are different than mine, and I think that's part of what I like about the park. The one other thing that really is always breathtaking for me, literally, and it's kind of ironic. So to come to the lake part of the park, I have to cross the pedestrian bridge over 198, which wasn't, of course, part of Olmsted's plan. That was originally a carriage road, so it was ground level. But now it's, you know, 20 feet above. So when I walk up and I get to almost the end of the bridge, all of a sudden I get this breathtaking view of the lake. And it's especially breathtaking in the early evening, which is my favorite time to see it, when you can see the reflection of the sun and the changing of colors of the clouds. But it's such an incredible view. And that's the other thing about this site that's amazing, because you've got the cemetery and then the psychiatric hospital, both of which are basically open space. So there's virtually nothing blocking your view of the horizon. And Buffalo has fantastic skies. It's just incredible to be able to see that right in the heart of the city.
Back to the Humanities Festival a little bit. I mean, this is going to be your first?
Yes, right.
Okay. The Humanities Festival, and just that concept of bringing people who study various elements of the humanities together to have this kind of conversation about this type of subject. What are your thoughts as a scholar?
Well, the festival is perfect for this, I think, because, again, we've often consigned the environment to technical specialists, whether scientists or engineers. But all the most interesting questions about the environment, what kind of environment we want and why, and how we're going to get there, are not technical questions. They require some of the insights of the humanities. History, philosophy, ethics, and the festival has some amazing talks. I mean, I wish I could go to them all. You have to choose at each time slot. And even in my slot, the chief sustainability officer for the University of Buffalo is speaking at the same time, and I'd love to hear what he says about all the interesting things that Buffalo businesses are doing to try to become more sustainable and how they make that case to their shareholders and officers and employees. But there'll be talks about environmental justice and about how you build sustainable community at the grassroots and, of course, ethics. So it's an incredibly rich array of conversations. So one day is those things. Friday night is Bill McKibben, one of the great environmentalists of our time, who's also become an activist. And actually, the Thursday night, the sort of pre-festival event, is a panel discussion of climate change and science and the humanities, which turns out I also got invited to be part of. So I'm really looking forward to that as well, because, again, I think the most interesting questions aren't scientific. And people have different ideas about what kind of environment they want and why, and it helps to tease that out and to get people with different ideas, because we often are siloed with people who think similarly to us.
What about for you then? I mean, you learning new things?
The newest and most exciting thing for me is coming to a city like Buffalo. I started my career at State College, Pennsylvania, so that's the middle of nowhere. And people, I was interested in urban stuff, but there wasn't anything around to get really people to think about that. So here, Buffalo, it's trying to have a renaissance to figure out how to be a great city in the 21st century. And part of that, I think, is going to be figuring out ways to be greener. And a lot of people are beginning to say, the old industrial cities are the right size and the right scale to do a lot of these things. They're big enough to have all the urban amenities, but they're small enough to still have manageable problems. For me at the festival and more generally just being in Buffalo and at the University of Buffalo, I'm really, really jazzed about seeing how people are thinking about that question. What can Buffalo do? How can Buffalo become a model for people not only in the United States but all over the globe who are trying to imagine what a greener, more sustainable, more vibrant, city would be? And how to get there, out of hard times,
Right. And I'm wondering, you must deal with this with your students, I would have to say, and maybe just in general public conversation, but is there a concept or a thought that you would offer to somebody or just the public in general to add to their thinking or to challenge their thinking when it comes to dealing with environmental issues? Somebody who might probably run up against people occasionally who, I don't buy that. I don't buy climate change. I don't buy this. I don't buy that. Rather than going into a long dissertation, perhaps, is there just a simple concept that you have in your mind?
I don't ever argue with people who say they don't buy the science. What I say to my students is, for me, the science is settled. Climate is changing. We're largely responsible. There's a lot of other questions that we can debate. Different people will have wildly different answers. There's no right answer. We'll be working our way toward whatever answer we come to as a society about what to do about it and how. But the other thing that I would say, and again, this is a question Olmsted thought about all the time, is what's your dreams for 50 years from now or 100 years or 150 years from now? If you have family, if you have kids, even if you don't have kids, you're just thinking about what's our future. And I think a lot of environmental issues, we think of them as trade-offs. You either do the environmental thing or you do something else. I think Olmsted was saying, nope, we can, if not have it all, at least have a hell of a lot. we can have communities that work in every way if we think about it and if we try. So even if you don't believe in the science, and there's a lot of people that are actually in this boat, they're not sure about climate change, but they know it would be better if we didn't produce as much pollution, or if we were more efficient in our use of resources, or if we had, you know, more beautiful surroundings and didn't spend as much time, you know, in our cars alone. All of those kind of things make for a better future. So that, I guess that's way more than one thing. But I would say try to think about what your hopes are for down the road.
You sound like an optimist.
I try to be.
despite the yeah. Maybe the facts?
Yeah, or? And my students are always inspiring. You know, and a lot of them aren't, you know, nature lovers, tree huggers. They're really practical kids, and, you know, they may go into marketing or engineering or you name it. But they understand this is a big challenge for their generation, especially, is how we reach a more sustainable future. And so seeing them at work and seeing them fired up, that also helps me stay fired up.
Right.